And then we're good.
Yeah.
Right. And then we'll use your audio. And yeah, I think that's it. If
Yeah.
that's it. All right. Do you guys want lights off or lights on?
What do you think?
Lights
What do
off
you
is
think?
good.
Lights off is good. Okay.
Good.
You kind of see? Okay.
Give a chair, Chris.
So,
wait, we need to get some more chairs. Let's just do a split.
Okay, we'll just take a minute and we'll get a little set up here. So,
would you prefer to sit or stand?
I'll stand.
Your backpack?
Okay.
That's my
Okay,
bag.
you have a chair if you want it.
Okay, I'll sit if
Okay.
I want.
It'll
You
maybe
can keep your
more
backpack on it if
backpack
you want.
on it. Cool, right?
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking. Would you like a Taco
Oh,
Bell?
maybe after.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Zine, what year are you?
What year?
Yeah.
Oh, so I'm a postdoc
Uh-huh.
at MIT. Yes.
And where were you before? Oh, sorry.
So I did my PhD in Japan, at University of Tokyo. So I'm a physicist
Yep.
by training. I already learned that there are a few physicists here.
Yep.
So before that, I was at Carnegie Mellon. I did physics and math as
Undergrad?
undergrad. Yes.
Oh, I see.
Yes.
That's great. Amazing. And so it's an interesting time. I feel like you know that your field is getting interesting when the physicists decide to show up.
No, thank you. Thank you. I get
Yes.
that.
Are you guys okay? Okay. All right, we'll figure this out.
That's
So
funny.
we'll put everybody here.
Balance.
And okay. All right. It's not plugged in yet. Yeah.
It showed up, right?
It did. It did
For
show up.
some reason.
I
You
wonder.
need to take it out and put it back
There's a
in.
remote here. Can I see the remote, you guys? Yeah, we'll play with it. Oh, there's something's going on. Maybe this is.
Oh,
Oh,
okay. Now
okay.
it's up
Maybe
here.
it's a hardware problem.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, will you share your screen on Zoom?
Oh, sorry.
It's okay. Wonderful.
They minimize the camera.
Oh yes.
This screen is
That's your screen.
that's my screen, but I'm sort of sitting
So
here.
yeah. So you go ahead and click OK on the recording, and then minimize the thing so that people can see your slides, or I can project if you want me to worry
Okay,
about the
this will
projection.
do.
You
Do the
can.
smaller. Do the
Th oh,
smallest
there's a
one.
like a little line on that. So you can go ahead and get rid of the little line.
The
Left
leftmost
most.
one.
Yeah.
Left.
Up on
The
the
frame of the paper
yeah, go to the people. Go to the
on the
people.
camera.
Yep. And then see the little line on the left?
Oh, this one?
Yep.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good thing. That's a good setting. Okay.
Okay, so
Welcome, Zian.
thank you.
I won't take time to introduce everybody in the lab, but you have a mix here of Northeastern folks and folks from other labs and other institutions who like to join our meeting. So Zian is so I don't know Zian. Who is that? So actually
I
Zian
invited him.
is Andy's guest. A trained physicist who is a postdoc at MIT right now. And so he was explaining to me in the hallway that he's going to be talking about the way that he thinks about learning and about irreversibility and some of these interesting sort of ways of looking at learning dynamics. So welcome, Zian. I'm looking forward to your talk.
Okay. Thank you, David, for the introduction. So I'm Liu Ziyin. Okay, today I'm going to talk about my research, which is basically the physics behind optimization and generalization. For most of you, so as David has said, I'm a theoretical physicist by training. So what I do is sort of to take tools and concepts and ideas from theoretical physics to understand how learning happens in neural networks. And to most of you, it will be a very, very strange talk. Both to the physicist theory and to the computer science theory, it will be a very, very strange talk. But I hope by the end of the talk, the computer scientist will learn a bit more about concepts from physics that they can borrow to help analyze neural networks. And maybe physicists in the room will learn a bit more about how physicists sort of are related very, very closely to neural networks work. Okay, so very recently, AI has become a very, very empirical field. We propose a lot of algorithms and we discover a lot of phenomena related to them. And we also propose various kinds of theories that explain these phenomena or understand these algorithms. But a key missing question, a key missing part are the organizing principles. So we don't know what are the fundamental laws, what are the principles behind the working of neural networks? Well, and what I believe is that in order to really get to the organizing principles, we can look at physics. We can take inspiration from physics. And modern physics, especially 20th century modern physics, have two primary organizing principles. And one is symmetry, the other is irreversibility. Sometimes that's a synonym of dissipation. Okay, so at the high symmetry, low irreversibility end, you have particle physics standard model. And at the high dissipation, high irreversibility, and low symmetry end, you have biophysics and chemistry. Okay. And it's no surprise that people have already sort of leveraged symmetry in the field of AI. And this is one very successful and common approach is to basically leverage the symmetries in the data and to design matching architectures. And so you all heard of the invariant neural networks, equivariant neural networks. And that's very well summarized in this very nice textbook called Geometric Deep Learning by Michael Bronstein. But in my opinion, especially to physicists, I think there's a key missing part, which is the symmetry in the model parameters. And that's sort of where my research start. As a physicist, we always ask the question of whenever we see a system, you ask yourself the question, is there any symmetry? And if so, do they determine the dynamics of the system in any way? So that's how I started my research. Okay, for the purpose of this presentation, I will focus on the very specific but universal and ubiquitous type of symmetry, which is permutation symmetry. Okay, so let us look at a generic neural network, F, and F can often be decomposed into multiple layers. So here you have D many layers, so F sub I is a layer. And within each layer, so each layer is permutation symmetric in its units, which we also call neurons. Okay. And this is because if you look at every layer, could be a fully connected layer, could be a self-attention layer. It's usually sort of defined as the summation over a generic nonlinear function sigma with weights W sub I and input X. Okay, so each of these W sub I is the weight, trainable weight of the ith unit. Okay, note that you can swap WI and WJ such that F sub I doesn't really change. So they really parameterize the same function. So that's a permutation symmetry in the layer. Okay, so here is a sort of a picture of a self-attention layer in a transformer. You can swap two attention tags such that the function you parameterize don't change. Okay, and here's another much simpler example, which is a fully connected layer. So you have one hidden layer here. And VI is the input weights to the first neuron. UI is the outgoing weights of the first neuron, and so are V2 and U2. And here you can swap V1, U1 together with V2, U2. So and you really parameterize the same function. So again, you have a lot of interesting permutation symmetry. So basically, in every layer you look, as long as you can define any notion of width, you must have a permutation symmetry. Okay, and one common phenomenon people have found is a very interesting phenomenon is that you can actually remove a lot of these units and still your model gets to train to essentially the same performance. So you can take some of your hards, you find that they are redundant, you can remove them, and you can still train your model, and they still work. Okay, and this is summarized by the famous lottery ticket hypothesis, which essentially states that any neural network can be compressed to a smaller network such that the training network doesn't change. And this is one thing that we found to be very, very related to the permutation symmetries of the layer. Okay, so here is the result. We proved that, I gave it a sort of arrogant name, which is called equivariance principle of learning. So it's essentially states that if you take any permutation symmetric layer, okay, any layer that looks like this, okay, and with neuron weights Wi, then any operator G that transforms your neurons, okay, so Wi and W2WD are the weights of the neurons, such that if this operator doesn't change the statistical moments of neurons in every small neighborhood, we'll leave the learning dynamics unchanged. Okay, so it's saying how you can change the weight distribution without really changing how the function is being learned. Okay, and you can really choose G to be those functions that strongly compress these neurons, that maybe set a lot of neurons to zero, or maybe set a lot of weights to zero, to and still you can apply this theorem. So that sort of explains how you can have lottery ticket hypothesis.
Which operator is used to modify the weights?
It is used to modify the weights. Yes. So it's a set of transformations you can apply to your weights. Maybe you change the first neuron by a little bit, second neuron by a little bit, and as long as that doesn't change the statistical moments, you will basically still learn the same function. Okay? And the idea is really simple. The reason why this works
It's,
is,
so I'm
yes,
sorry.
please.
So it was just for context. Oh, what was this? This was your paper, is that right?
Yeah, this is my paper.
And is this a hypothesis or is it something that you were able to prove?
This is actually a theorem, so we actually proved this. Of course, there are a little bit regularity conditions. You have to assume that the functions are smooth. You have to assume that the neurons live on a bounded space. But yes, this is something we proved. Yes.
And then the definition of learning dynamics are unchanged. What does that mean?
Okay. So here it really means that if you look at f of x as a function, this function, the way it evolves through time, is the same for the two different distributions of neurons.
So how do you what do you mean by evolution? So clearly, if you
Okay.
perturb something like setting a weight to zero, then it's going to be a little different.
Yeah.
So in what in which in like how do you say that it's essentially the same?
Okay. It's essentially this. Okay. They are the same in the asymptotic sense. So if you, okay, you take one distribution of neurons and take another distribution of neurons and you train the two networks and you look at how f of x changed through time, and you will see that there are some small differences, but you can show that these small differences vanishes as you take the infinite width limit. So
I
when you,
see.
yes, so it's an asymptotic result. Yes. Okay.
So the moments would be of f, like of
Of
f,
the
right?
neurons.
Yeah.
Of the neurons.
So what's your
It'll be clear in the next slide. Yes. Yes.
is that kind of saying as like a result that there's like a continuous space between the size of the network that shrinks down? Some substantial difference that asymptotically goes away. Kind of say all the as a string, so we can kind of connect it on different.
Yes, so it certainly has to do with, for example, mode connectivity of neural networks, right? But we do believe that the solution space of neural networks is highly degenerate. There are a lot of ways that parameterize the same function, and this is really sort of a different way of looking at the same phenomenon. Yes.
But now the theorem is actually a theorem about the distribution of functions, not just a function, right? The distribution of learned functions. Is that right?
It's not about a distribution of function. It's about one single function
Well,
that's
then it's
parameterized by, let's say, D many neurons. I'm saying that if you give me D many neurons that parameterizes this layer, I can replace these D neurons with another set of D neurons such that the par function they parameterize are the same. And even during training, they are always the same. So I can replace my neuron weights by another set of weights such that they don't really
I
change.
see. So, and the thing that is being fixed is like the data, the training data or something
The
like that.
training data are being fixed, yes.
So the transformation is at initialization.
The transformation could happen any point in time. You can do it at initialization, and that essentially gave you the LTH, but you can also do the transformation, let's say, in the middle of the training, that still works, yes. Okay, so here is sort of why it works. The reason really why this works is because permutation symmetry sort of gives you an emergent notion of distance between neurons. So every neuron is sort of parameterized by its weight. So okay, so each WI is sort of the coordinate of the neuron, and you can imagine that these neurons live on a high-dimensional manifold. Okay, and you can really look at and when you have a lot of them on the high in space, a lot of them will be clustered. So you can sort of you can how do you call it? You can look at small neighborhoods in a space. So each of dot here is a neuron, and if you can find a neighborhood that where there is a lot of neurons, they will essentially be redundant. Okay, neurons that are close to each other are redundant, and therefore you can sort of compress them into fewer neurons, and you can actually do this compression in a way that the learning dynamics is really the same. So that's essentially what's happening here. So you can summarize a lot of neurons with very few neurons. Of course, you don't have to do the compression. You can just, as I said, it's an equivariance principle. You don't have to compress them. Of course, one of the uses will be to compress them. Okay, and here is a sort of a experiment that does this. So we learn a very simple low-dimensional function that looks like this. Yes,
So
please.
sorry. So your theorem is about one layer at a time, is that right?
Yes, it only applies to a single layer. Okay, by single layer, you sort of need you basically anything that looks like this.
Okay,
Yes.
that makes
So
sense.
take any submodule of network that looks like this, and you basically have D neurons here, and
Okay.
you can apply the theorem.
Yeah.
I have a question about this.
Yes, please.
Where are the weights of the second layer? I mean, so here you said all of the weights of the second layer of the MLP to one or something. So the layers don't really look like this, right?
What do you mean?
I mean, I wonder,
Like there's an extra weight that multiplies after the nonlinearity, is what he's saying.
definitely.
Yes.
Where is it?
The neural network starts to become
Uh-huh.
non-trivial, and so when you have the second layer of weight.
Yes, so basically the way you define a neuron is to is the outgoing weight and incoming weight concatenated together. So you have to, so it has to be a two-layer structure if you are looking at a fully connected layer. So these two
Right.
weight vectors together forms a neuron.
So that condition
And
for
so
the for a deficit.
say it again.
The neurons are the activation for a given deficit.
The neurons, well, they.
It's the output of sigma here, right? Each neuron is output.
Yes, well, the. Okay, it's tricky. So, okay. So, yes, usually we think of the node as a neuron, but here I'm saying that it's the weights
For example.
coming to it, which is VI, and the weight leaving it, UI, forms the coordinate of the neuron. So, these two coordinates together parameterizes the neuron. So, it's the weights that parameterize the neuron. Okay, so it's really these four edges that I call this neuron, not the node itself that I call the neuron.
Is it the parameters or
It is the
the
parameters.
activation?
It is the parameters. Yes.
So you're using some, this is, so is that why you took the comma and you have like this sigma and then WI comma X? This is kind of a non-standard.
Yes. This is a non-standard way, but if you write it this way, you can. It also applies to transformers to self-attention layers. If you,
Sorry.
yes. So here, WI here is really sort of VI UI together is your W1, and V2 U2 together is your W2. Okay. So you see, you take a sum of two things, and okay. So this sigma is actually not this sigma.
Yeah.
So your sigma
So,
actually have to include both things
but like
to connect to this definition.
V1
Yes.
is actually a two-dimensional vector or
Yes.
something,
Yes.
and U1 is also a two-dimensional vector.
Yes.
Okay,
And then
so
so each of the
that's
neuron is four
confusing.
dimensional. Okay.
So that's right.
So yes.
And
That's a more
so
like
there's a linear aspect
hypothetical.
to what's going on, but so
Okay.
you've got this tensor structure, this sparse structure that. So that's why you don't have a dot product here anymore, right? So it's like, but there's so do you does your theorem depend on, like, there's a linear structure and then you have this nonlinear operation that happens still, or
No,
it's
it
still no? Because
it
there still is a linear structure when you write it like this, right? Or maybe not.
You sort of need a linear structure outside each of the neurons. You sort of need it in the technical parts of the theorem. But for the purpose of this talk, you can really imagine this kind of neuron. So you have a generic sigma that's a generic function of W, right? You can have some linear parts outside the hidden nonlinearities of sigma, but it, not necessarily. Yes.
Just like as a wish for your future talk to some random machine learning people, you could connect it to, you know, our daily bread. Like where we write down the layers very different, right? It's like just to.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like yeah. If you like, so the thing on the right looks a little bit more familiar.
Yeah.
Right. The thing on the right. Oh yeah, that's daily bread.
Then you should add some circles or
something. Yeah. You almost want to like say, oh, you know, yeah. step, and then the thing on the right, yeah. Right? The thing on the left, right? Yeah.
Yes, yes, thank you. So basically, yes. So this is a neuron. So U I and W I are the neuron of, are the your first neuron. In this case, it's four-dimensional. Okay. Okay. So what it really means is that it induces a notion of Euclidean distance between your neurons. So every neuron is parameterized by its weight. Okay. So this dot could be a neuron in your fully connected layer, or could be a self-attention dot in your self-attention layer. Okay. And so what we do here is basically we learn a very simple function. Well, of course, it's a two-dimensional function, and we train a neural network. So the blue line, sorry, the green line is a training of a standard small neural network trained with Kami init. And the blue dashed line is what you train with, is where we train a much wider network. And the orange line has the same width as the green line, but I initialize it in a way that it matches the bigger network according to the theorem. Okay, and you see that once you match the moments as the theorem requires, you really have the same learning dynamics. Okay, so you see the orange line is really the same as the blue line.
Oh, this is really cool.
Yes, so that tells you how the learning dynamics is really invariant to these reparameterizations, okay? And it also applies to other optimizers such as RMS Prop and Adam W, for example.
What's the reparameterization you're doing here?
You have to look at the theorem.
Matching the moments of the bigger network.
So you divide space into little cells, and within each little cell, you construct a smaller set of neurons such that all of its statistical moments in this cell is the same as the statistical moments here.
I see. So the left one is a bigger network because it has more dots.
Yes, yes.
The right one is a smaller network with
fewer
dots.
Yes.
And so you're saying like a few. Yeah. Okay. You're dividing.
So you're sort of doing the lottery ticket thing here, right? So you're saying, okay, well, we have our random initialization.
Yes.
And we're going to subsample it, but instead of just subsampling it randomly, I'm going to subsample it by, you know, by tiling this space according to this metric more uniformly than it would be if I had just drawn everything from Grafton's.
Yes. So you not only have to subsample, you also have to transform your weights a little bit. You have to make them match the original network a little bit.
Oh, so it's not just subsampling.
It's not just subsampling. You have to have additional stuff, which is to really sort of make sure your smaller network match the statistics of the higher of the larger network. I would call it a proof of a variant of the lottery ticket hypothesis, but it's it requires one additional step, which is to transform the weights.
Yes, and can you give a little bit of intuition about this transformation of the weights? Is it just an averaging procedure where you take the proper weights and you find sort of a centroid of them or something, or is it more complicated than this kind of thing?
So it is essentially the same as you measure its first moment, which are the averages, and second moment and third moment, you try to match every one of the moments. And there's a theorem that guarantees that you can actually match them up to every order and perfectly. It's called Chakalov theorem. And that also allows you to really match the moments with very few neurons. So there's an underlying and interesting mathematical theorem that allows you to match these moments.
Beautiful.
So it's really as simple as matching the moments, but it's actually a little bit tricky to how to match them.
What if that is in your paper?
Yeah, they're all in my paper.
It's so cool. It's like for the
Good.
first time, the lottery ticket stuff becomes concrete, you know. I don't mean, you know, like,
Yes. I'm very happy to hear
it's
that.
always like, yeah, it kind
Yes.
of sounds correct, but I don't know what to make of it, right?
There are certainly
Actually, it's actually
limitations to
concrete
the
too.
theorem. You see that, for example, you're really sort of trying to divide space into little cells, but that's really bad because of the curse of dimensionality. So there are a lot of caveats to the result, yes. Okay, now I can move on to the second part of the first part. Okay, so we have talked about how permutation symmetry gives you an inherent emergent notion of Euclidean distance within every layer. So and there's a way to really sort of say that in a very formal way, which is what we call this second theorem, which is topological phases of training. So what we showed that is if you take any permutation symmetric layer, again, fully connected or self-attention hats, and with neuron weights Wi, then the learning dynamics can be divided into two different phases. The first is a smaller neural phase where the topology of neurons are preserved. So what that means is that if your neurons are close to each other at the beginning of training, they will stay close, and if they're far away, they will stay far away. And the second phase is the large learning rate phase, where the topology of neurons will simplify. So what that means is that neurons that were far away could become closer, but again, those were close cannot be separated. So you actually you have they get essentially closer
Oh, it's just
together.
irreversibility.
It is, yes, it is
Wow.
irreversibility. So the second part is irreversible. So this is a pictorial illustration of that. So we initialize the neurons on a ring. And if you train at a smaller
Wait,
neural
that's
rate
the sticky
theta,
neurons that I was talking about.
what'd you say?
That's the sticky neurons that I
Oh,
was
yeah, I
talking
think he'll
about.
talk about he likes sticky
Yeah,
neurons
I
too.
like stick neurons together. Well, maybe I'll talk about that. Yes. Yes. So at a smaller neural rate, you learn really by deforming the ring. Okay. But you don't really change the topology. You have a hole there and they stay connected, but you only change the shape of it. But if you train at a larger learning rate, you actually start to twist things, and that's a change of the topological structure, and part of your neuron actually becomes lower dimensional. Okay, and here are experiments. So we really initialize the neurons on a two-dimensional, well, actually on a ring, which is a one-dimensional manifold. And here is what happens when you have a small learning rate. Okay, so this is how the distribution of neuron changes, and this is the training loss. Okay. And you see that if you increase the learning rate a little bit, you have larger change in the shape, but still you don't really change the topology. But if you have a very strong, very high learning rate, you see that you actually do change the topology. A lot of neurons actually collapse to this point, and therefore giving you a very strange topology at the end. And in this case, actually changing the topology actually makes the learning happen much easier.
So here the student is
Yes.
bigger than the teacher.
It's much bigger than a teacher. So it's to say that the distribution of the neurons doesn't really have to match some of the teacher distribution. Yes. Okay. So there's one more thing that I want to tell you very quickly about. It relates to the merging of neurons you talked about, but I'll be very brief here. So what symmetries, in particular permutation symmetry, really leads to is a separation of two phases. Okay. So you have a phase. So whenever you have symmetries, you can actually sort of show that your loss landscape locally will take this shape. Okay, it's like a Mexican hat. And there's a symmetric state where two neurons are identical. Okay, so neurons merge into each other. They are you, you're really the same as a smaller network. And there's a second symmetry broken phase where two neurons are separate. So you effectively have a larger network. Okay, so we had a series of results that essentially prove the following two things. Let's say establish the following two things. So the first of all, the higher your symmetry, higher the symmetry in your weights, of course, when you have these symmetries, then the lower the expressivity of your neurons. So basically, it's the same thing here. If two neurons are identical, you're essentially having a lower dimensional model, and if you have stronger regularization during training, you will converge to higher and higher symmetric states. Okay, so if you apply that to permutation symmetry, that really means that, for example, if you train with weight decay, your neurons will tend to collapse onto each other. Okay, you will tend to get identical neurons. Okay, so basically, this is the illustration of that when you have basically two neurons here. And when the two neurons are identical, it's really having the same neuron but with slightly bigger weights for the output weights. Okay. And you see that when you have multiple layers and when you have many, many neurons within same layer, there are a lot of hierarchies you can have, right? For example, it's possible for these two neurons to be identical. It's possible to for these three neurons to be identical, and so on. You have essentially exponentially many hierarchies that could exist there. Okay, and here is the training of a four-layer MLP on the CIFAR-10 data set. Okay, here, sorry, they are wiggling a little bit. I plot the neuron similarity matrix of every hidden layer. So basically, how close are the weights of each neuron in every layer to each other? So you see that during training, the second layer and the third layer actually has a lot of neurons that collapse onto a single huge neuron, which I don't know why. But this actually happens a lot when you train with Adam on CIFAR-10. So in the two hidden intermediate layers, you have a bunch of identical neurons after training.
Why does it get stuck there?
Why does it get stuck there? Probably you don't need that many neurons to learn the CIFAR-10,
But like,
is my guess.
could there be ever gradients
That take you away?
yeah.
Okay, so that's basically what the theorem established, which is that whenever you have regularization, such as with decay, you're energetically preferred to go to these identical neuron states. Yes. Okay. So here's a recap of the first part of the talk. Okay, actually, I have time. So the first is basically parameter symmetries are ubiquitous and they give rise to redundancies in the weights. Okay, you have them in attention layers, in fully connected layers, and essentially everywhere. And every symmetry subgroup leads to essentially two phases. Again, let's talk about the permutation symmetry. So the symmetric phase is where two neurons are identical, and symmetric broken phase are where two neurons are different. Okay, and the hierarchy of subgroups corresponds to a hierarchy of complexities. So basically, what these two figures are talking about. If you had higher symmetric states, for example, 100 neurons are identical to each other, of course you have a low expressivity. And if you have strong regularization, weight decay, actually noise also helps you get there. You go to a higher symmetric state, so neurons are more likely to merge into each other. Okay. Oh, before I start the second part, is there any question?
Maybe if you can comment on, like,
Uh-huh.
so given that regularization increases symmetry and symmetry decreases expressivity, is this something that we generally want when we train networks or like?
Yes, okay. That's a very good question. There's a certainly a trade-off, right? You on the one hand, you want a high expressivity network that allows you to fit the function, but people do believe that you want the simplest function
That's
that
right.
fits your data, right? So you sort of want a balance point between there's, let's say, a sweet spot of symmetries and expressivity that you want to
That's
achieve.
right.
Yes.
So the machine learning word is generalization. Do you really try to relate symmetry to generalization or expressivity versus generalization kind of ask that of here, or is that something that's a different topic for you?
Actually, that's one thing we are working on right now. It's actually a very quite difficult thing, but I'm collaborating with statisticians and mathematicians to actually make the link strong. But intuitively, you can already see it right there, right? Because expressivity is directly linked to generalization gap, right? The more expressive you are, the bigger hypothesis you class you have, and therefore you tend to have a bigger
Memorization.
memorization, for example. So you do expect it to be strongly related, but it's still unclear how you can go directly from symmetry to generalization. We're working on that. Yes.
Can I ask this?
Yes,
So I
please.
found one thing that I found really interesting is that you studied a student that is bigger, and I talked to another a professor at this conference, and he told me this result that like you basically can. Let's say you have a neural network, right? It has some weights.
Yes.
You can't you kind of can't distill it into the same size, same architecture neural network. It's hard. There's some paper, but if you make it bigger, if you make the student bigger, you actually can, right? So something about the
Wait,
learning gets easier.
you can't fit the teacher,
So
or you are saying,
exactly
or
like you even so you take
yeah.
teacher exact copy paste. Student, random init the weights. Now you're trying to match the teacher, right? But just based on input output, that doesn't work.
Yes, that's right, yes.
But if you take a big student, it can match the teacher. It's kind of strange, like
Yeah.
it connects to this
People say that
delivery
a
technique.
lot, but I'm not too familiar with the literature on teacher-student setting. It's actually a very common theoretical setting. So I don't have a good answer, but yeah, right? The wider you are, the more easily you get to train them, and therefore the easier they
So
fit the
I guess you're
function, right?
saying like your results are saying like I can if I would initialize only my student correctly using the moments of the teacher, I would be good, right? But like
Yes. So yes, you only need to. Okay. Yes, that's a very good
then
point.
here in here things
Yes.
collapsed in some way, here it will collapse in another way, and I'm not gonna get good
Yes, actually, that's
results.
very good. So yes, you only need to match the moments of the teacher. So there's no need for you to really. It's sort of impossible for you to
But
really
like,
recover.
if I just
Yes.
use my standard toolkit, I'm not gonna match the moments.
Yes.
But like, if I make a huge thing, I'm gonna match the moments.
I think so, yes.
All right.
Actually, that's a very good point. I think you're right, but I think it's an open
Yeah.
problem. A very
Do you
interesting
have
point.
the paper?
I can dig it out.
Is it
It's the
equal
old
to just
paper.
like replicate the
Yeah.
result and then just match the moments and show that actually you can train the student of a same size if you only do this like nice moment matching procedure? Yeah.
Yes, but should I think I should continue. Maybe I'll leave the questions at the end, or do we have enough time? When am
We
I
haven't
supposed to
yet
end?
to.
Yeah,
We're
we usually
relaxed.
run over.
Okay,
So.
I'll answer questions then.
Can you go back to the graph that
Okay.
Chris pointed out in Build Bowl, where you did the moment matching experiment and showed that the loss of the smaller model basically like replicated? Yeah.
Yes.
Can you explain the pr so. Is the moment matching thing where you take the you match so also I'm just like sketching out my understanding of this experiment in the hopes that you'll correct me if I misunderstand something, but what I think you described was the flat line is just like training just the smaller model without knowledge of anything bigger. Then you took a bigger model, you trained it just in the normal way. And then at every step of like at every training step, you did some kind of process where you did like a sort of weight transfer where you took the statistical properties where you did like a distribution matching thing, right?
Yeah, we only match it at the initial at the first step. So it's not every step we match it. We will only match it at the first step and we do the standard training. Yes.
Oh my God, wait, that's
Yeah.
even cool.
That's very cool,
Okay.
actually. Yes, that's a very cool result. Yes.
I would not, like, I didn't understand, like, so you're taking, like, a fully trained large model to initialize a small model, so, like,
No, we take two networks that are in. Okay,
neither
so
one's
both the
trained.
big
Yeah.
and smaller network are random and initialization.
And so there's no awareness of the training data
There's
whatsoever.
no aware of,
It's up.
yes, there's no awareness.
If you match the moments of the neuron, the neuron actually refers to the vectors that you define. Yes.
Yeah.
Which is like concatenation of some,
The input and output weights is a little bit
sort of
more.
the, yeah.
So
Yes.
is this a correct intuition? So in the higher dimensional like weight space that the larger model gives you like just by like combinatorics, you have way more like hypotheses you can test in the space,
Yes,
but you
yes.
also get way more redundancies as well. So
Yes,
you're like
yes.
you're transferring over like the larger number of like hypotheses or like the more interesting like distributional properties from the higher dimensional space while also getting rid of the redundancies, and that's how you can like lower it down
Yes,
to like a
exactly.
smaller
Yes,
model
yes.
while still like preserving a lot of interesting structure that like a typical initialization of the smaller model wouldn't get to
Yes,
with
exactly.
normal initialization.
Yes. So that's basically what, yes, that's the essence of the equivariance principle of learning, which basically states that a lot of weight distributions really parameterize the same learning dynamics. There's a huge redundancy. Yes.
And so could like
Yeah.
is this just really expensive to do the mode measurement?
It is very expensive, yes. But I hope there's some more there's I hope there are cheaper ways, faster ways, maybe approximate ways to do them. But if you want to do the exact one, It's actually quite so. It's polynomial time, but it's not good.
But if it doesn't depend at all on the training data, then it seems like a reasonable thing to do is to understand the statistics of what would result from the moment matching process, and then you can just initialize your small networks in this way to have those statistics.
Yes. So you can imagine writing a dictionary of initializations, right? You pre-compute all your initializations so that your smaller network really sort of role plays as a bigger network when you train. So it's imaginable that we can do that, yes.
Turn it into a PyTorch function or something.
But like
Yes.
you are also saying at the same time, this is not what we are doing. And this is so
But he's just taking this random initialization
no, but
and
like
he's distilling it into some other
right,
not
but
so
like
random
here's the
initialization.
connection that I'm gonna draw to our field. There's these people that think about superposition
Ah, I see.
and they are like, okay, but maybe our networks are fucked because they are simulating this huge network, right? Right, they're like that would really fuck our network, right? And make it really hard to interpret, right?
Yes.
It would oh, everything is like all of these directions and
We don't have enough dimensions for
everything
all
means
information, yeah.
multiple things and stuff. So yeah, that's the additional to add more to the confusion.
Yes. I think you have a huge equivalence class that, of course.
So that's actually, if you're right, then that's not what's happening. So, like, the
Oh,
solution
okay,
is not,
interesting.
right? No idea happening. No, but like the models tend in this notion of neurons or something, the standard setting of training, you actually collapse to the
Oh, smaller.
smaller class. If
All right.
so, and if you wanted to collapse to the bigger network,
You
you
have to
would have to
initialize
match the
specially.
moments,
That's
right?
right. That's
So
right. So,
it's a kind of a contradiction.
interesting. It's a contradiction.
Yeah.
It's like the existence of there is an existence of a small network that might not have these problems. We just don't know how to initialize them.
We are not
Yes.
getting them for free, right?
So
Or are
initialization
we?
is definitely interesting and
Yeah.
difficult. So there's a recent paper by Brian Chan. I don't know if you know him.
Yeah.
He's an MIT
Sure. No,
postdoc.
Brian. Yeah.
Yes. And
He
he
spoke
had
to.
a not paper called Network of Theseus,
Right.
very recent. They showed that if you match a MLP to a, for example, a CNN, a ResNet at initialization. So if you match their basically representations at initialization, they actually trying to reach the same accuracy on ImageNet.
Right.
Here.
So it's actually
Cool.
very related to the result I
It's
had.
related.
Yes, it's very strongly
Here.
related.
I'm sorry. I'm just putting the camera on you
Oh.
because your thing is just
Yes.
looking at the ceiling. If you want to, you can put it on here
Yes,
too.
yes.
Okay.
We
Sorry.
close the door
Yeah.
if it's possible.
Okay.
Okay. So, okay, let me start the second part. Okay.
Can we close the door?
Thank you.
Okay. So I have talked about how just simple permutation symmetries allows you to very strongly and interestingly characterize the learning process of neural networks. And there's actually a key missing part to that picture, which is the fact that the training process are stochastic of neural networks. You have to sample data points and you train according to the stochastic loss functions or data sampling. Okay, and that's really so that's answered by the second part of this talk, which is irreversibility. So here I really only talk about the irreversibility in the training process. Of course, I think they will also be very important for the information process of a neural network, but we're starting to work on that and we don't have result yet. But so let's only focus on the training. Okay, let's look at a generic training algorithm. Okay, so this is a discrete time generic training algorithm. Eta is your learning rate and U is your generic learning algorithm. It could be Adam, could be STD, but for most of the time, let's imagine STD, okay? And what you can show is that training on this discrete time algorithm is the same as evolving this continuous time algorithm, which is essentially the first term is the same as your learning rule, but you also have a second order in the learning rate emergent term that we call the entropic force of training. And you can actually establish a bunch of physics results showing that this term is actually really the dissipation rate of this discrete time. a stochastic process. So you could be stochastic. It can depend on randomly random samples of the data. Okay, and I will refer to this term as Knobloch. Okay, and it turns out that two very interesting and universal phenomena in deep learning are actually related to this term. To this very simple term, you can actually explain two phenomena. The first is the recent Platonic representation hypothesis. So people have found that if you have two large neural networks trained on related data sets, and they tend to learn very similar, they tend to encode data points in very similar, if not identical ways. And the second is a more optimization phenomena called edge of stability. So it states that any neural network at training will slowly lose stability, eventually staying at the tipping point, which is called the edge of stability. It is more technical, but it is actually very universal. If you look at the original paper by Jeremy Cohen, they actually showed like a million networks have this phenomenon. Okay, and to sort of
So can you give a little
yes,
bit more
yes.
intuition about delta S or nabla S?
Yes, I will give you more intuitions
Okay.
very, very, very soon in the next slide. Okay, so to foreshadow the result, what essentially happens is that this term will actually break all continuous symmetries of your original training algorithm, which is you. So what that means is that suppose your original loss function look like this, and you have a huge degenerate manifold of solutions. The second term will sort of tilt your solution to favor one of the huge degenerate one solutions in the huge degenerate manifold of solutions. Okay, so this is what the result, what this result is all about. And okay, so if you apply it to the problem of the Platonic representation hypothesis, what I will show is basically that among all the different ways of representing the data, the Platonic way of representing them is actually favored because of this second term. Okay, there's a you shouldn't have seen the second part. Okay. So I will for the rest of the talk, I will specialize to focus on SGD. So here U is really the gradient of your loss function, and the second term, which I call the entropic term, will take this form. Okay, so you are taking the gradient of this function, which is the norm of the stochastic gradient itself. Okay. So this term really has the straightforward meaning that your training process at a finite learning rate eta prefers those learning trajectories that minimize its fluctuation. Okay, so you prefer minimal gradient fluctuation solutions or training trajectories. So this is a straightforward meaning of that.
What's the expectation over the
It's
expectation?
over the training set.
Okay.
Yes. And you can actually apply the look at what this term really looks like for a single layer. So let's look at a single fully connected layer. H is the post-activation of the previous layer. W is the trainable weight of this layer, and P is basically the pre-activation of the next layer. Let's look at this layer. Well, and you and we want to look at what the entropy loss really look like for this specific layer. And you can just do the computation. And apply the chain rule, you see that it's a multiply, it's a product of the neuron gradient. So it's the gradient with respect to P, multiplying the representation H itself. Okay. Okay. And therefore, the norm of it is really the norm of the gradient multiplying the norm of the representation. Therefore, the second term really encourages you to learn in two ways. First of all, you are encouraged to learn the most compact representation. Okay, you want to have a small, you want all your representations H to be as small as possible. Okay, and you also want your gradient to be as small as possible. That's why actually people see a lot of low rank gradient phenomena. My hypothesis is that it's actually due to the first term. So let me,
So
yes.
I'm still trying to get
Yes.
intuition here. So is the second term talking about something? So I'm not following. Is the second term
So this is
following
the
from the
instantiation of the effective dynamics
for
for
STD,
SGD for
yes.
SGD?
So
So
he
yeah.
spent a whole month for something to derive this equation.
Right. So
Yes.
is the second term coming from the S in SGD? Is it from the stochastic, or is it, what is the second term from? Yeah.
Very good. It comes from a combination of two terms. The first is the discretization error. That's why you see a factor of eta here, right? And the second is the stochasticity. So this second term, you can actually decompose it again into a mean part and a fluctuation part. The fluctuation part comes from stochasticity, and the mean part comes from discretization error.
Okay, so if you were to do full batch gradient descent instead of stochastic gradient descent, and if you were to do it in infinite precision, then you would have no second term.
You will have no second term. If you do full batch gradient flow, you will not have second term.
Ah, with a I see.
Yes, because
As a differential equation system.
if you do discrete time finite step size gradient descent, you still have the this term is still there, but you only have the mean part, not the fluctuation part.
I see.
So there is some effect, but it's much weaker.
I see.
Yes. So it's a combination of two effects, discretization error and stochasticity of training. And that leads to this emergent form that minimizes essentially the norm of the training algorithm.
So if you take bigger steps and smaller batches, then you will have higher dissipative effects.
You will have higher dissipative effects, and you will see that your average gradients will be much smaller. So if you increase your learning rate, that actually causes the gradient to become small. It's a very common effect. I should have I don't have a figure here, but I have seen that 1,000 times. So it's very robust. Yes.
Your effective learning rate goes down.
It's difficult to say because really it's the product of the two that gives the effective learning rate.
I see, but what you're really doing when you have your physical learning rate high is you're putting it all into the second term. You're just bouncing around all over the place, and but your effective learning rate might not
It could go down,
it
actually.
could actually go
Yes,
down.
yes,
It's a
yes.
bit smaller.
Yes, yes. Yes, so that's the right interpretation, yes.
So what quantity gets preserved?
What quantity gets preserved?
Yeah. Like
What do you mean?
if you increase the learning rate, you're saying your gradients decrease.
You can sort of
But
say
the
that
effective
their
learning still
product are
gets preserved.
not preserved. It increases still, but slow at a slower rate than you would expect naively. Yes. Okay, in the rest of the part two, I will talk about three minimal models. So they are very simple mathematical models that you can solve exactly that will give rise to three interesting phenomena. And the first is a phenomena of phase transition. And we look at a very simple problem. Okay, so this is our loss function. You have two trainable parameters, W and V, and you have a stochastic sampling of data point X. Okay, and X has expectation value and a variance. Okay. And you can really compute the entropic loss. Okay, so the first term again is the same as the original loss function in expectation, and there is a emergent term. Okay, so you really minimize this thing if you're training with SGD. So you see that the second term encourages W and V to be as small as possible, and that leads to that predicts a phase transition where at a critical learning rate you will actually prefer both W and V going to zero.
So
Yes, please.
SGD is implicitly regularized, you're
It
saying?
is implicit regularized by the noise and finite
I
step
see.
size.
And you formalize it by calculating this F.
Yes.
How do you get this? Like,
This term,
where does this F come from?
it's not difficult to compute. I will encourage you to read our paper. You basically ask yourself the question, and you basically do this analysis. You try to find an integral that approximates your discrete time dynamics, and you will see to leading order, it's really this term. It's easy to do. We can talk
Thank you,
about
Mark.
it. Yes.
That's good.
Yes, it's easy to do.
It's
Okay.
the problem.
Yes. Integral.
Derivative
Yes.
equations.
Yes, but it's actually a second order expansion, and you get it very soon.
I think I could work it out.
Yes, that's the essential message. Yes. Okay, so this is really the simulation of training with SGD on this loss function. You see that it's unbounded, right? The global minimum is where U times V is basically infinity. And here is what happens. So you see that at high learning rate, you see that actually they converge to the saddle point at zero at a high learning rate because of this entropic term. You see, initially they are sort of spread out, but as you train, they actually get closer and closer to the saddle point. That's a example of a
Without any weight decay or anything.
there's no weight decay in this example. Okay, so this actually has to do with symmetry. So this point is actually the symmetric state of the Z2 symmetry. Here,
Wait, sorry, what are your labels?
okay, there's no label. You see, the loss function is very simple.
Okay, you want your thing to output 0 every
to
time.
basically correlate with X. No, okay. To minimize this loss function, you want your W and V to correlate with X.
Wait, I'm confused.
Correlate. So W and
Yes.
V could get any value,
Yes,
right?
yes, yes.
As long as
So
X
if
is 1, you want to be minus 1.
yes, yes,
So you want to be minus infinity?
and minus infinity,
Oh,
yes.
yeah.
So that's why it's unbounded.
Right.
Yes, but yet the training process really prefer not learning anything at a high learning rate. That's the message here. So even if to minimize the loss function, you need to go negative infinity, but you actually don't go there
So,
at high learning
for
rate.
like small learning rates, you might go to a negative infinity-ish.
Yes, for small learning rate, yes, you will escape always, yes. So there's a what we call a critical point. That's where a phase
Where
transition
the
happens.
second term kind of takes over.
Yes, yeah, where the second term dominates the first term. Yes, good. Okay, and you can also solve a phase diagram. I'll just skip it. And now let's look at the second phenomena, which is edge of stability. And here, let's look at a slightly more complicated problem. Okay, so we have a MSE loss function, and our label is y hat, which is generated by a linear teacher v, and has some inherent zero mean noise epsilon. And we train with SGD with basically a batch size of 1, and our model is a deep linear network. Okay, it's a simple model, but it actually is strongly nonlinear in terms of the learning dynamics and in terms of the loss landscape, and it also has the notion of representations. So it's actually a very good minimal model of
The notion of what?
representations,
Representation.
right? Since with
Because of
W,
the layers.
yeah, because of the hidden layers, right? So Wi times X is the first hidden layer representation, and so on.
Think that just one comment. I think it's super interesting to see this, like, because when I learned about like machine learning, deep learning stuff, like this case was always dismissed, right? Because like you could write it as one matrix.
This is the boring case.
Right, but it actually has different learning dynamics. That's what you're saying.
Yes, when you are deeper,
So
yes.
if you are, you spend some effort, then it's actually a difference.
Yes, so it's actually a very good model of learning dynamics. Maybe it's not a good model
That's
of
it. That's
expressivity, but I think
thanks
it's
for
a.
healing us. Yeah. Thanks for
Thank
healing the room.
you for thanking me. Okay, so here's the prediction. I'll jump through all the math, but here's the prediction. If the training does minimize the gradient fluctuation, which is basically the entropic term, then higher label noise imbalance. So basically, the imbalance on epsilon. So epsilon is a vector, and you can look at its spectrum covariance. If some label has low variance and some label has high variance, that's an imbalance, will lead to higher sharpness. Okay. So here is what happens during the training of one such deep linear networks. And we either have an isotropic label noise on the labels or a non-isotropic label noise on the labels. And you can see that the global minimum for your loss function actually doesn't change. So epsilon doesn't change your landscape at all, whereas it actually changes the solution you converge to. At a high anisotropy, you go to sharper solutions. Okay, so these are the trace of the Hessian. So that means a sharper place. Whereas if you have isotropic label noise, you prefer a flat solution.
Can you explain why we would predict that? I didn't actually catch why.
That's very technical. You will have to prove 10 theorems about this loss
But
function.
is there an intuition for why you would why are we measuring sharpness also? Yes, whatever.
Okay. Because, okay, so this is trying to explain a phenomena
Oh,
called edge of stability.
right.
Edge of stability consists of two different but universal phenomena. The first part is called progressive sharpening. So it's saying that if you train any of your model, you see that basically the sharpness increases as you train. So basically, that's actually this part. It increases as you train.
Right.
That's a universal phenomenon, appears across many models. And the second part is that you stay at a critical value.
And this like place where you stay is determined by the learning rate, usually.
Determined by the learning rate.
Right.
And
But
this
here you're saying it's actually it can be determined by the label norms.
it is dependent, yes. So it is saying that you don't always have edge of stability. You only get it when your label noise is strongly unbalanced. Yes. So this theory explains the first part of edge of stability, which is called progressive sharpening. It explains why you get to sharper and sharper places. And that's because of the label noise imbalance. And that's actually very common, for example, for language tasks, right? Imagine the uncertainty of two different words, right? The word Jack versus the word, I don't know, triumvirate. They are very different. So that's why you actually see it universally in real data.
So, but now, so your the result comes from all the your technical proof,
Yeah, it is. Yes.
but like, all right, but then you must have some intuition.
That's much harder. Okay, there's some intuition. So the key mechanism I think is very clear. It's that so people in the past used to say that SDD training, for example, prefers flat minimum, right? That used to be a very common and popular thing to say. But the key prediction of this theory is that SDD has no preference a priori for flatness or sharpness at all. It only has a preference for low fluctuation. And it's partially coincidental that for some data distributions, the minimal fluctuation solution tend to be a flat one. For other data distributions, the minimal fluctuation solution tend to be a very sharp one. And it's not completely a coincidence. You have to leverage a lot of symmetries in the model to see why, in this case, isotropic noise leads to flatness, but it's not so straightforward. So, actually, that's one thing I'm still working on. I'm still thinking about deeply. It would be nice, in my opinion, if I can really name a, let's say, a simple mechanism where it's actually where I can just tell you. I hope I can there get there, but we're not getting there as of today. Yes. Okay, and you can test the same thing on a variety of neural networks. So what we plot here is x-axis is the condition number of the label noise spectrum. So that tells you how imbalanced they are and the sharpness. And you see that basically having a conditional number of one, meaning that your noise is completely isotropic, that always corresponds to the flattest solution you get to. Whereas if you increase the imbalance, you always get to sharper solutions. Okay, so you can link it to basically the Mexican hat picture I just said, which is basically you really have a lot of different ways to learn a function mapping. But there are also a lot of symmetries in the model, right? Because you're deep, you have two models, you have two layers at least, and you can scale up one layer and you can scale down the other layer. And it turns out that only some of those scalings are really preferred by your learning algorithm. And those are the ones that corresponds to edge of stability. But more precisely, I mean, progressive sharpening. And the other ones are not favored by the learning algorithm. Okay. Now let's talk about the last phenomena I will talk about, which is the Platonic representation hypothesis. It's a slightly more complicated model than what I have just shown. So now instead of training on Z, sorry, training on X, we train on a transformed X. Okay, so instead of seeing X, the model sees X hat, which is a linear transformation of X, and Z is a full rank matrix. So it doesn't really lose information. So you still have essentially the same data. But transformed. They have different, for example, distance relationships between different data points. And we have the same loss function, we have the same label noise, and we have the same model. And notice that here you really have a notion of representation, and therefore we can really talk about whether representations are aligned. And here's the prediction. If the training minimizes gradient fluctuation, Then the learned representations, basically all the learned representations, are independent of Z. So no matter how you transform your data point, you will always learn the same representation. Okay.
Why
Yes,
do you
please.
predict that? Why does minimizing gradient fluctuation imply that? Or are we skipping the
It's sort of related to what I said in the first slides of the second part, where I said when you have the entropic term for a fully connected layer, it encourages you to have the sort of the most compact representation. So they that sort of gives you that sort of gives you a preference to, let's say, non-redundant compact representations. So that's a very indirect argument I can give
And then
you.
there's an implicit additional step where, like, the most compact representations are unique or something.
The most compact ones that are equivariant to the input transformations are platonic. So there's the equivariance part that I sort of skipped here in order to not to confuse you. Yes.
If I want to go from HD minus one, okay, no, never mind. Sorry.
So that, yes.
And so to complete the sentence, under what assumptions is it so you're saying, oh, it's the same representation if we initialize our WIs the same way, or under
Yes. So here, what you can prove is that if this model reaches the global minimum of what we call the entropic loss, then there's only one way to represent the data. And so as long as you reach the global minimum, there's only one way, and that's the Platonic way. That's the way that's independent of Z. That's the way where you actually will essentially cancel out the Z in the first layer. Yes. Okay, and here's a simulation of that. Again, this is really a deep linear network. And we train two different networks on two different, well, related but transformed data. Okay, and you see that the representation. So here I plot the representation similarity in one of the hidden layers, for two different networks. And you see that at the beginning of training they are really not similar, but as you train, they actually essentially encode data in exactly the same way. Okay, so this is a case where you can actually reach perfect representation alignment across data.
Was the last layer invert Z or the first layer?
It's the first layer will always invert Z,
The closest to the input or?
closest to the input. So what you can so what's also the case that if you only look at the same network, all different layers will be aligned to each other. So you don't need two networks. Let's say you have one network and you have two hidden layers, and those two hidden layers really have the same representation up to rotation. So yes, there's a side effect.
Does anything change if you use like a ResNet architecture here?
Okay.
A linear? Okay.
So here the theory is only done on linear, deep linear models. It's very unclear what will happen for nonlinear models. It's in my opinion, a very huge, interesting open problem. Actually, even the PRH itself, whether it has to do with linear structures, right?
What about like
Yes.
what if we did like linear ResNet? Like identity plus W1? Identity plus W2. Would that change anything?
I think you will still see very strong alignment, but I'm not sure if you will actually get perfect alignment. So here what you can prove is that you get 100% alignment. They only differ up to a rotation. But if you have residual connections, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I hope it's still the case, but it's very difficult to analyze. But maybe doable. I'll think about it.
Sorry,
Yes.
still the case, right? Because identity plus a matrix is basically the same thing.
You hope it's the same case, but that dramatically changes your learning dynamics. Yes, you really parameterize the same function, right? They really have the same expressivity, but deep
Because it's
learning
more
is,
expensive.
yes, but deep learning is not invariant to reparameterizations because of the nonlinearity in the learning dynamics. So I can't say at the top of my head. I hope it is true, and I can hypothesize it is true, but I don't know. Yes.
Let's say before you're creating,
Say it again.
like before you even done, even done, like it's just some kind of initialization before you have done any kind of training. Because there is no nonlinearity involved in this PPN work,
But you see
you
different
can
date.
teleport me. like
Do you?
what you're saying that you, I mean, in different ages you have the similarity in your presentations.
No, not really. The reason is that you actually have infinitely many different ways of representing the data for the deep linear network because of the symmetry. And here is why. Here is why. So if you look at a deep linear network, you can transform the previous layer by invertible transformation, linear invertible transformation T, and you can transform the next layer by T inverse, such that, sorry, this T inverse should appear on the other side. And by doing that, you still get a global minimum. You still learn the same function, but you represent data in completely different ways. So out of all the infinitely many different ways of representing the data, you actually prefer the one that are platonic, that actually cancel your Z's. Okay? It's a very non-trivial phenomena that you actually try cancel it, and it's due to the basically the entropic term. It's the minimization of the second term that takes you to these solutions. Okay, that's I wish yes.
And you're hoping that this also explains generalization. That you're hoping that, oh, there's something special about, this optimal.
Could relate. I hope it could be relatable to generalization. And again, that's one thing we are really working on.
And does it and is the intuition that, so you keep on bringing up symmetry. So is the intuition that this point is the maximally symmetric point or something like that? Or so you brought this up in a couple of the examples. Huh?
I think that's a very tempting thing to say, that maybe when you have symmetry, you prefer the maximally symmetric state, but it's actually unclear so far whether that's the case or not. Here it's a combination of two effects. The first, you do have symmetry. So basically you have many ways of representing the same data, and that also exists in nonlinear models. So I would assume similar effects will happen there. And the second effect is the irreversibility of the training process. You prefer, so you sort of have to throw away your initial information before you can sort of get to a universal sort of shared representation, right? So that's what the irreversibility is sort of about. So you need two effects, at least for this specific exactly solvable model. I can't say if that's the maximally symmetric state or not. It doesn't seem to be, actually. Yes. Maybe in some strange hidden space it is, but we are actually not sure about that, yes. Okay, so that essentially finishes the theoretical framework that I want to present to you. The idea is simple. When you have symmetries, that really creates different phases, a hierarchy of phases where you have low expressivity at symmetric states and higher expressivity at symmetry broken states. And regularization will take you between these two states. And also, when you have a lot of neurons, that naturally leads to a huge manifold of solutions. And irreversibility sort of prefers specific solutions along the degenerate manifold. And that gives rise to interesting phenomena, such as platonic representation and edge of stability. And there's the last question. If I have time, I can talk about it. If I don't have time, I'll just end here, which is whether you can make use of it. So should I continue or should
Well,
I?
continue. Yeah, people feel free to leave if they've got a conflict, but yeah.
Okay, before I start, do I have any questions? Okay, now I have talked about so much about really solving exactly solvable technical models. There's a interesting remaining question, which is whether we can make use of it. Well, I personally do think we can make a lot of use of it. And as the simplest example, let's consider what we call the law of parsimony. Well, it's not only a law, I think a principle for machine learning, but it's also a principle for science and for our ordinary life, which states that of among all the competing hypotheses, we always choose the simplest one, right? And in the case of machine learning, here's how you frame it. So basically, you want to learn a mapping from X to Y, from input to the label, and you have a model which takes X as input and is parameterized by your weights, which is theta. And okay, and you, for example, and one instance of that is basically you want to find your model that learns the mapping such that as many theta I is zero as possible. So you want the most sparse representation, parameterization of your model. And sometimes we believe that it's the simplest. Okay, and the classical way of doing it is less so, right? You train your model and you add a L1 penalty, and that naturally gives you a sparse parameterization. But let's ask a different question, which is how would a physicist solve this problem? How would Feynman solve it? How would Einstein solve it? How would Landau solve it? Here's what I think. Okay. The physicist would try to leverage what is known to every physicist, which is continuous symmetry breaking. Okay, so what you will do is that you take every parameter theta I and you couple it to a new dynamical trainable variable VI. Okay, note that it sort of creates artificial new symmetries in the model. Okay, this is what you do. So you take your original model, which is f of theta, to f of theta element-wise product V. So V has the same dimension as theta. So th this effectively doubles your parameter count, but it also creates additional symmetries. Okay, so the symmetric state is where theta I equal to VI equal to zero. And sim okay, I have a figure actually. Okay, I'll say that at the end. Okay, and what you do is that you try to minimize the energy, which is your loss function. Could be anything, but here I wrote it as a MSE. And you try minimize it at a finite temperature. Okay. And then immediately the fundamental laws of physics tells you two things. If breaking the theta I symmetry reduces energy L, then theta I will be non-zero. That's the symmetry broken state. And if that doesn't help you reduce the energy L, theta I will be zero. So that's the symmetric state. So this is called the Landau theory of phase transitions. Okay. So here is a figure of that. The symmetry of this additional redundant artificial parameterization is theta I equal to VI equal to zero. And the symmetry broken state is where theta I, VI are non-zero. Okay. And here is our simple algorithm. Okay. We redundantly parameterize our model by doubling its parameter count, and we have a regularization term. And if you leverage the theory we have proved previously, you know that you should add a regularization, and the higher the regularization, the higher symmetric states you go to. And this term, in physics words, is really the temperatures. Okay, so whenever we study temperature, it actually looks like this. It's like a L2 decay. Okay, and this is what happens if you really just train it with Adam or STD. This is a MNIST problem. So you see that very naturally you learn. So there's a two hidden layer neural network fully connected, and you see that you very naturally learn a very sparse neural network that are in principle more interpretable than a dense network. And this is what happens if you train without train a vanilla model that doesn't have this strange parameterization. You basically get a very dense solution. Okay, so very naturally, you leveraged symmetry to build interpretable and sparse model that are maybe also more efficient. Okay, and we also applied it to compress larger models, ResNet 18. They actually work very, very well. You can compress ResNet 18 by 1,000 times without really affecting its performance. You can also compress pre-trained models. So here we compressed a pre-trained ResNet 50 on ImageNet. It's also working very well. And now let's do an exercise. Okay. We have learned all the great things about symmetry. Okay. Suppose now I want my model really divides into sub-modules. Okay. So theta is your parameter, and it has D sub-modules parameterized each by W sub I. Okay. So W1 is the weight of the first module, and WD is the weight of the last module. And suppose you want to make as many modules to be zero as possible. What would you do as a physicist? Anyone?
Learn some coefficient for each one.
Yeah, something like that, right?
Multiply it.
Basically, it's like a mask,
Yeah,
right?
learnable noise.
Right? So basically, you couple each WI to a scalar VI and train at a finite temperature, okay? That naturally creates two phases where they are either zero or they are non-zero, which is the symmetry broken state. And finite temperature encourages you to find those solutions that uses as few modules as possible. Oh, okay, and we apply this to a gene selection task, which is one of the old problems in AI for science. And we want to basically find the genes that are really relevant to certain disease, to certain cancer. And we want to not only learn the mapping, we also want to identify those genes that are really relevant. So basically, you apply this thing to every encoder of the of every gene. So we encode every gene with a different encoder, and we apply the additional coupling to every encoder. And the method actually works very well. It actually identifies, let's say, 50 something relevant genes and working very well, leveraging the deep learning technology. So you can actually do very interesting nonlinear feature selection by leveraging these techniques.
So all you do
Yes.
is you just insert a little an extra multiplicative parameter
And you have
back here.
a finite temperature, which is basically the way it decays. Yes. Okay. So wait. Now I have really talked about everything about symmetry and irreducibility, and it really seems like deep learning can be a part of physics. Is that really true? Well, let's recall this figure, where I stated at the very beginning, where symmetry and irreducibility are the two organizing principles of physics. And could there be a place for AI on this map? Well, I personally believe it's actually right here. It's where you have a very high degrees of symmetries because of how redundant your models are, and there's a very strong sense notion of irreducibility due to the learning process. Okay, thank you very much. That's really the end of the talk.
You close to hitting the job market as a prof, or?
Yes, I am on the job
Okay.
market.
A really good part.
Oh, thank you. Should be shorter
Well,
or longer.
see. Doing some of the questions. I have a question about the photonic.
Oh, yes.
Could you back classify? I didn't understand exactly what you were plotting, like in the heat maps. So what do you plot? Like, what are you plotting exactly?
Okay, so this is the representation similarity. Okay, so have you seen any of these?
This is the centered kernel alignment stuff that they use. Is that right?
Yes. This is the CKA, right?
Analysis. Right,
You.
right. But so, are you comparing two networks?
So yes. So this is the representation similarity for network A. Okay, so this is how network A encodes the distance relationship between two data points. Okay,
Oh, I see.
so a yellow here means that they are encoded in a very similar way.
Why doesn't that be start like already structured at like step zero?
Maybe has to do with the form of the data being very
Okay.
isotropic
But
there.
the main point of this figure is that like by the end of their training, these two things look similar.
Yeah, so okay. Maybe that's one decision mistake I made, which is to actually give network B a slightly bigger learning rate. So actually, okay, you have to wait it. Okay, once it go back to step zero, you will see that it actually learned very fast. So it's actually very okay. You see that?
Yeah,
It's actually very different at the beginning, but it gets to
but we really care
the
about like the snapshot at step 100 or something, the fact
yeah.
that these two are similar.
Yes, the point is that eventually, let's say after training, they get to similar representations.
Right. Okay, and then the other thing. So, would you hypothesize that deep learning just would not work if we could do gradient flow, like, and that the like good stuff of gradient of deep learning is a coincidence of like the fact that we need to discretize stuff, and that's where all the like magic happens. That's fun.
That's a good.
Because like
We're out of memory, out of time.
yeah, that's where the second term. That's where the second term came. Like the interesting term was the difference between doing gradient flow and discrete gradient descent, and you're like, oh, like it leads to all this like cool, interesting stuff, and maybe it's actually the important part of learning. So would deep learning not work if we train things with gradient flow?
Maybe there's a different way of asking this question. So there's
Yeah.
something that happens when you train this way. Is it better?
That's a very good question. So I So what tend to happen when you really train with gradient flow is that it will keep a lot of information of its initialization. So basically, if you train it that way, people usually find it works. But you also see that they learn things that are not quite not interpretable, quite not comparable to other neural networks. So irreversibility definitely gives you some sense of universality. So there's something that's useful about it, but whether you get better performance, actually, I don't know. There are evidences. Some people claim that when you have the second order term, that actually gives you better performance a little bit, because that gives you, let's say, more compact representations. So there are people who say that, but it's so far unclear how important that is.
Is there a way to study this empirically? Like, can you, or besides just doing like really, really small learning rates, like, is there a way to study gradient flow empirically?
Yes, there's a paper actually called it's
You just solve for the mean? Wait,
there,
no, no, that's not gonna tell. Wait.
yeah,
Yeah, I don't know.
there's a paper I think from a few years back. It's called Stochasticity is Not Necessary for Generalization.
Oh, yeah.
So what they did was that they train with gradient descent, but they also explicitly add in this term to gradient descent
Like offset it.
to sort of to have the effect of second order term, but not really having it as a emergent term. So they put this in explicitly into the training. That actually gives you slightly better performance, 5 to roughly, let's say, 5% improvement on CFR10, something like that. So it's seems to be a little bit helpful, having this term for some problems, but I think it's unclear yet.
CFR10 is a lot.
So it is a lot. So it's a huge gap for deep learning, but it's not a huge gap if you are comparing deep learning to, right, to non-deep learning methods. Yes. So there are evidence where this term actually helps.
What is this term from one?
Say it again.
What is this term from one?
What does it jump
The
from?
muon optimizer.
Sorry?
Do you know muon?
Oh.
So
Oh, the...
that was German pronounced. Muon, do you know
Muon. Yeah,
muon?
physicists would say muon,
Yeah,
but
you start muon.
I don't know. I that's an interesting open problem. Yeah.
Another good thing.
Another exercise. Yes.
So you have this very interesting thing of like, oh, you can do these simple things in the end based on the theory. So would you, I mean, so you're here you are talking to an interpretability lab. Would you advocate that my students should go and try training all sorts of masks? And these extra parameters into their models that this might lead to a clearer view of what's going on inside the models.
Okay, I think there are really sort of two messages here for the purpose of interpretability, right? The first is the explicit engineering part, right? By incorporating these strange masks, you get to incorporate the desired type of sparsity you want. Any structure di sparsity you can achieve with by building in these strange things. So that's a engineering sort of message. But these strange masks already exist implicitly in some of them, implicitly in many of the existing neural architectures. So the other way to use this is to actually analyze the existing ones. For example, in Transformer, you have those strange symmetries. You can figure out their symmetric states, and you know that you are adaptively preferring to get to those symmetric states. One example is, for example, the key and query matrices in the self-attention layer. That's a yes, and that's actually a symmetry. It has a lot of Z2 symmetries, and you can identify the symmetric states, which are basically the low rank states for those layers. And the theory directly predicts for you that, for example, if you train with weight decay, those query key matrices will be low rank, for example. So there are two ways to use them. Either you analyze existing symmetries or irreversibility. Actually, they can combine, as I have shown, in existing models, or you can build artificial symmetries into your model, and build more
I
interpretable
see. So it leads
models.
to low rank, which is maybe why, as an engineering matter, we only give a really small number of ranks, to them, because they would waste them anyway. So, right, yeah. There's an old architecture called StyleGAN, which has an interesting multiplication in the middle of the architecture, and it always came out more interpretable than all the other networks. And so there's this weird echo of adding this extra multiplication in the middle.
I didn't know that, but it could be the case that by introducing these redundant degrees of freedom, you actually make your model more interpretable. Actually, yeah, that could be a good thought. Yes.
Interesting. So, faculty question would be, oh, this is really, really great work for your first trick as a student postdoc. So, what's next? So, what if you were to set up a lab, what are you going to do next?
Okay. I think personally, I think there are a lot of missing steps, even to the SIF, to this framework. One thing is basically, I think, what you have asked about, how does it really relate to generalization? So I think having a first principled connection between SIF and statistical learning theory will help us understand a lot more about both about deep learning and also about, let's say, symmetry and irreducibility. So that also, in principle, could contribute back to science. And SIF, I think, is a really great framework for understanding phenomena. And so that also gives, for example, the conventional statistical learning theory sort of the lens of phenomenology, if we really build that link. So that's definitely one thing. The next thing, for example, I'm also interested in applications. For example, I talked about how you can build in artificial symmetries to make your model more efficient, more sparse, more interpretable. So I think that route we can go very far, and there are a lot more to be done there. It's actually an old idea in physics. It's called sort of called symmetry engineering. So we want a material that has, for example, high conductance. And the way you really solve it is not to look for specific materials. You look for symmetries because we know we can build theories based on symmetries alone. And we know that, for example, this symmetry class will correspond to better resistance, better conductance. So if we have a theory for symmetry, we can only look for those symmetries, and then we identify materials that have these symmetries. So that's also a very interesting new design principle kind of thinking that I think people in machine learning could also have. What's the third? I personally believe it's sort of a new physics in a way. If we really believe in symmetry and irreducibility, then I think it's very physical. I think that's the short-term plan I have. Longer plan, I'm really sort of interested in neuroscience as well. And I also sort of believe that symmetry irreducibility will also be two fundamental principles for biological learning, right? Because symmetry is really sort of you can in the most general form, it's sort of some sort of redundancy, right? And we do know that human brains are highly redundant. When you are born, you have much more synapses, much more connections in your brain, and we actually prune them very quickly at the first stage of development. So we are born with a high degree of redundancy, and that's really sort of what symmetry really means. And we also know that, for example, our brain is really irreversible, right? There are a lot of critical periods in our brain. I personally think SIF could also eventually be a part of neuroscience.
Leo, I have one question. So, I used to be very motivated about the theory of deep learning until I kind of felt like I cannot contribute to this. And also then I started my PhD and I felt like really disappointed by the theory of deep learning because none of the results make predictions. And then I was like, oh, okay, I'm gonna wait. And now it feels like you guys are suddenly doing stuff. But like why I got attracted to Mekin was like I was like hoping that like us poking around in the actual models will deliver like some stuff that theory people could get inspired by. Were you inspired by any mechanism?
I certainly
I mean, now we have a large collection of like mechanisms that we find in the models that are trained and that are sitting around.
Yes, I really. So first of all, I believe deep learning and AI is becoming an empirical field and sort of should be an empirical field. And by that, I really mean that it's actually experiment driven, it's phenomenology driven. And I do think the real foundation there is experiments, is the phenomenology. And then you start to build theories based on it, right? For example, part of my theories are driven by these phenomena, edge of stability, Platon and gravitation hypothesis. So yeah, they really form the foundation of my work, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.